This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll share news of a recent victory in the case of Professor Sami El-Aryan.
We interview his daughter, Layla El-Aryan, to tell us about the incredible 11-year struggle that finally resulted in dismissal of all charges.
We'll talk about a recent U.S. Supreme Court decision in the labor case, Harris v. Quinn.
The Supreme Court conservative majority continues its efforts to cut back on the rights of public sector organizing and unions.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the National Lawyers Guild.
And I'm Michael Ratner, president emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
Michael, there was a significant case coming out of Chile with respect to Charles Horman.
Our listeners may not be aware of who Charles Horman is. If you've seen the film Missing, a Costa Gavras film, it's about the killing of Charles Horman. The Center for Constitutional Rights has been representing Joyce Horman and the Horman family since 1973. We'll all recall September 11th was the coup in Chile that overthrew Allende. As a result of that coup, thousands were killed. Two Americans, Frank Teruggi and Charles Horman, were picked up, apparently taken to the stadium, and murdered. Charles was a 31-year-old journalist in Chile, and there were always many allegations swirling around regarding whether the U.S. officials cooperated in his murder by the Chileans. The center brought a series of cases. We didn't get far. We got some evidence. Charles Horman had apparently seen some of the military maneuvers up in Valparaiso, Chile. He had been picked up by a U.S. official and given a ride back, a man named Captain Ray Davis, who had offered assistance to Charles and his partner at the time, or his wife, Joyce Horman, got them through military roadblocks, etc. And here's what Joyce said in the context of this. In his role as a spy master, speaking about the American captain, Ray Davis, if I might put it this way, he was interested in understanding who Charles was and who we were. Quote, he was amenable to talking and discussion and certainly plenty of questions we felt were intrusive. Joyce Horman says that new evidence now indicates her husband and Teruggi were tagged by a Chilean naval official who passed on information. The court, which just ruled in Chile right now, a few days ago, also determined that Ray Davis, the U.S. official, had in fact passed on information to Chilean officials. As Joyce Horman says, that's a direct link with Ray Davis, who was a U.S. Navy official and had good connections to the Chilean Navy all the way to the top. What Joyce Horman hopes is that the court's ruling will reopen the American investigation into her husband's death. And then she quotes, she finally says, for the United States to have a hand in the death of an American journalist 40 years ago, and their behavior not having been addressed 40 years ago, almost 41 now, permits the same kind of non-democratic, murderous behavior on the part of certain sectors of the U.S. government. Davis, the man who apparently fingered Charles Horman, died in a nursing home last year. So it's a significant ruling. It just shows you what kind of longevity you need in this world to get at the bottom of U.S. complicity in murders all over the world. So thank you, Joyce, for staying with it. Thank you to the Chilean court.
Michael Ratner, over the years we've talked about the Center for Constitutional Rights lawsuits against the contractor Khaki and Titan. What's happening with those?
Well, one of the cases is surviving, and that's the case against Khaki. Khaki is Khaki Premier Technology, and they were one of the private military contractors involved in Abu Ghraib. And what U.S. military investigators determined in 2004 was that Khaki had participated in torture and other, quote, sadistic, blatant, and wanton criminal abuses of detainees at Abu Ghraib. Despite that finding by U.S. investigators, and despite the fact that we represented a number of the victims of that abuse, a district court federal judge dismissed our case against them after a recent decision in the Supreme Court on another matter but related, a case called Kiobel. Without going into all the details about it. What Kiobel said was, if you're suing for torture that happens overseas, that you have to have a strong connection to the United States. Kiobel concerned torture or abuse that took place in Nigeria with regard to oil drilling, etc. And they said there wasn't enough connection in that case necessarily to continue the case in a U.S. court. In the Kaki case, we argued that even despite Kiobel, there was enough connection with the United States to continue the case against this private contractor. The case is called El Shamari v. Kaki International. And the question was there enough or sufficient contacts with the United States that you could continue the case against Kaki on behalf of the men who were subject to electric shock, sexual violence, forced nudity, broken bones, deprivation of oxygen, food and water?
Heidi? Michael, give me an example of what a connection would be. Does it mean that the money was coming from the U.S., that the chain of command had some connection?
Well, I'll give you what they said in this case, which will give us a sense. They are going to vary in cases. The Court of Appeals, which is important, the Fourth Circuit, found that we can continue the case because the human rights abuses in Abu Ghraib in Iraq were committed, one, by a U.S. corporation at a U.S.-controlled prison in Iraq in a conspiracy with U.S. soldiers. So it does touch and concern the United States sufficiently to permit the claims to proceed. It's a big, important victory. As Bahar Azmi, the legal director of the Center for Constitutional Rights, said, this is an important ruling, not just for our clients who have sought justice for over a decade. The center's been at this for 10 years. It affirms the vitality of human rights litigation, even after the Supreme Court's decision in Kiobel. So it's a really important victory. And I remember when we brought this case, we had decided not to go directly against the United States because we'd been losing steadily on immunity issues. So we said, maybe we'll do better against the private corporation. Yes, we did better, but of course it's taken us 10 years to do better. But it's still a significant ruling. It gets around or distinguishes a Supreme Court case that many thought was a death knell for this kind of international human rights litigation.
Congratulations.
Great victory.
Michael Ratner, we have a big birthday coming up.
It is a big birthday. It's Julian Assange's birthday on July 3rd, a few days ago, July 3rd, and he was born in 1971. He has just turned 43 years old. He's having a small birthday party. At least a few friends come to the embassy where he remains, really, actually having been given political asylum by the Ecuadorians. He remains in the Ecuador embassy in London. I hope that we don't have to celebrate another birthday for Julian Assange in that embassy in Ecuador, but I hope he will be given the safe passage to Ecuador, which he's entitled to under the asylum law, that the UK, Sweden, and the United States recognize that the asylum he's been granted trumps all of their efforts to persecute Julian Assange for the important work he's done to really, as I sometimes call it, split the sky open on this world and give us all the information about governments and private corporations that we need to understand the repression of this world. Thank you and happy birthday, Julian Assange.
A very happy birthday, Julian. Michael Smith, last week the U.S. Supreme Court dealt another blow to women's rights, and this involved a case where once again we're seeing First Amendment rights given to corporations.
Yeah, exactly. And in this case, by doing that, it was a frontal attack on the rights of women, mostly poor women, I would guess, who now can't get insurance for contraceptives. For example, an IUD costs a low-wage worker about a month's wages, and they can no longer get insurance to cover that because Hobby Lobby is owned by a family. That's what they call in the law a closely held corporation.
And what is Hobby Lobby?
Well, you know, they buy stuff from China, hobby stuff, and they have a chain of stores around the country, and they sell this stuff. But a family owns it. So the Supreme Court, in its wisdom, said because it's a closely held corporation, it's a to their religious right to have to pay into an insurance fund that would then pay for women's reproductive rights. So therefore, women who work for this company can't get it. Interestingly, men who work for this company can still get vasectomies.
Let me give you an interesting example, Ruth Ginsburg went after this on this closely held corporation stuff, and she dissented, a very strong dissent. So I was thinking about, you could have a big corporation, huge, that's closely held. And would that mean that they no longer have to provide money for contraception through the insurance plans? It's actually not direct money for contraception. It's saying our insurance costs, let's say, $10,000 a year for each person. And within that, the person can do whatever they need, get contraception, get this. But in any case, this question of closely held corporations. So Hobby Lobby is owned by a few, closely held. But think about a company like Wendy's. Wendy's, this huge hamburger place, thousands of outlets all over the place. Also, very good argument that it's a closely held corporation. A few big hedge fund people own almost the whole thing. So does that mean that paper places like Wendy's? I mean, the thing is nonsensical, this business.
Can we just go back? Let's define closely held. So right. It means just a few entities.
Didn't define it. Does Ruth Ginsburg say something about it?
In this case, Hobby Lobby is owned by a family, and that was their definition. Ginsburg says, for example, in her 35-page, quite powerful dissent, she says, the exemption sought by Hobby Lobby would deny legions of women who do not hold their employer's belief access to contraceptive coverage. Because Hobby Lobby is owned by people who are of a certain Christian faith, and they don't believe in contraception, and therefore they don't want to have to contribute to their employees getting it.
But didn't one of the justices, and maybe I just read this, say that no one was being forced? It differs slightly from infringing on one's religious practice because they weren't forcing this on everyone.
As I said, you have an insurance plan. Right. Like you get health insurance from wherever you get it. I get it. And within that plan, you can do all kinds of things. You can either take the contraception or you can't. Right. You can either decide to be operated on or
you're not. No one's forcing you to use the contraceptive.
No, it's just part of an insurance plan. And it was only four types of contraceptives because this particular religious belief wasn't about all contraception.
Really?
It was about four particular kinds.
Oh.
I can't name them.
Right.
But one of them, because Justice Ginsburg talks about it, it's an IU, an intrauterine device, costs about $1,000 for a woman to get in. It's considered very safe, et cetera, very, very good on preventing pregnancy. And she says, what's a woman going to do now? $1,000 she has to come up with to be able to pay for this device? Where's that going to come from? So, Michael, do you want to talk about her dissent a little bit?
Yeah, well, she says this is, she says the court, because of this decision, has ventured into a minefield. And then she pokes at him and she says, would the exemption extend to employers with religiously grounded objections to blood transfusions, you know, Jehovah Witnesses, antidepressants, Scientologists, medications derived from pigs, including anesthesia, intravenous fluids and pills coated with a gelatin, certain Muslims,
and Jews and Hindus,
and vaccinations? Not much help here for the lower courts bound by today's decision. That's why she calls it a minefield. And the interesting thing is this decision is based on a 1993 religious freedom law, which had to do with individuals. So the court really had to twist itself to, again, define a corporation as a person.
As a person.
I'll believe that the day a corporation is a person is the day it gets a colonoscopy.
Well, if you're a small-held corporation, you might. Anyway, the decision, I think, correctly, as you said, Michael, is a continuing attack on women and women's right to contraception, women's right to have, you know, the kind of sexual lives they want to lead. And it's really trying to put women back into, if that's an accurate description of it, the Victorian era.
This reminded me of our discussion a week or so ago about the good Supreme Court decision on cell phones not being subject to searches and seizures without a warrant. And I know one analyst remarked in the New York Times that they felt that all of the justices could understand the implications because they likely all had a cell phone and so looked at it from a personal angle. And I think that if these justices had a more direct connection to the issue of, say, a daughter who needed birth control.
Let's also remember there are five men who made this decision. None of them have women's sexual organs.
Right.
Three women dissented from this. Heidi, we rest our case.
We rest our case.
Well, it's also remember that these are right-wing Catholics against abortion, and they're bringing their personal views into this.
I think as we talk about the Supreme Court, the cutbacks on really what I would say women's rights, labor rights, treating corporations as if they were people, the wars this country is going through, the immigration stuff that Obama now is increasing, you know, to get rid of the kids coming across. I mean, it's really sad and outrageous. You know, I think things haven't changed, at least in a certain respect, since this incredible speech, The Meaning of the 4th of July for the Negro. It's by Frederick Douglass. It was a speech given at Rochester, New York, July 5th, 1852. It's a speech I recommend to everybody, the entire speech. But Heidi will read us one of the famous passages, which we try and read every year here on the 4th of July.
What to the American slave is your 4th of July? I answer, a day that reveals to him, more than all other days in the year, the gross injustice and cruelty to which he is the constant victim. To him, your celebration is a sham, your boasted liberty, an unholy license, your national greatness, swelling vanity, your sound of rejoicing are empty and heartless, your denunciation of tyrants, brass-fronted impudence, your shout of liberty and equality, hollow mockery, your prayers and hymns, your sermons and thanksgivings, with all your religious parade and solemnity, are to him mere bombast, fraud, deception, impiety, and hypocrisy, a thin veil to cover up crimes which would disgrace a nation of savages. There is not a nation on the earth guilty of practices more shocking and bloody than are the people of the United States at this very hour.
In very good news, last week, the U.S. Department of Justice dropped all of its criminal charges, prosecutions, etc., of activist and Palestinian professor Sami El-Aryan. They've been trying to persecute, charge him, etc., for over 11 years. The case began in 2003 as a criminal case. Although he was charged with some 14 counts, he was convicted of none. Rather than face trial again, El-Aryan pled guilty to one count, served some time, and most of us thought it was over by then. He had an agreement that he couldn't be further prosecuted, they couldn't go after him any longer, but that he could be deported. Unfortunately, the Department of Justice had what you would have to call an Islamophobic vendetta against Sami El-Aryan, and they went after him again. First with a civil contempt of a grand jury, he did time for that, and then in something utterly unusual, they charged him with criminal contempt. The criminal contempt case was pending for 5 years. Finally, last week, the Department of Justice, the prosecutors, dismissed that case. We happily and gladly welcome back Sami El-Aryan's daughter, Leila El-Aryan, a Washington, D.C.-based journalist.
Leila El-Aryan, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thank you so much for having me.
And we're just so thrilled to have you with the good news that we heard about last week about your father with dismissal of all charges. Michael Ratner wanted to go through quickly the procedural history.
As Heidi said, we've talked to you before on the show about your dad, Sami El-Aryan, and it's been a saga for your family and for him for 11 years. I think 2003 was the indictment. But first of all, how are you feeling? How's your father feeling? I mean, it's a pretty major thing that's finally happened. I know it's not all incredible. It's been 11 years, and there's going to be a deportation. But give us some sense of what the feeling is in your household, your dad.
I think, you know, we're feeling a huge sense of relief that this nightmare finally appears to be coming to an end. We're really happy. We're very happy to hear about the government dismissing the charges against my father. And in a way, it's vindication from my father. We've said from the very beginning, it's been 11 years, and we've said all along that this was a political case. And I think the government's decision to finally dismiss the charges against him and hopefully let him go is really a reiteration of the points we've been making for so long, a confirmation of that it is a political case. Because if my father truly were a criminal, they would try their utmost to keep him in prison. Not to say that political prisoners aren't, you know, often arrested unjustly, tried, and imprisoned, but you know, we're hoping that this finally means that the saga will end and that my father will be able to live as a free man.
Let's start sort of, not the beginning, but near at least the beginning. He was indicted in 2003. And what was that about and what preceded it? Was it some work he was doing for charitable organizations, et cetera?
Well, what preceded it was really a decade of harassment of my family, the FBI, basically tapping our phone calls, and not just my father's, but my siblings and I as well. So really, you know, when you think about the Snowden disclosures and the NSA spying on people, I mean, for us, this is a reality. We had no sense of privacy growing up simply because my father was a Palestinian activist who dared to challenge the common narrative that you normally hear in the United States. Because he wanted to advocate on behalf of an occupied people, he himself a stateless person, and because he really dared to offer a different perspective and to try to help people being subjugated and occupied. So because of that, he became a target not only of the FBI, but also of really powerful pro-Israel voices and forces here in the U.S. who tried to smear his name for many, many years, accused him of being a terrorist. So that was part of it, because he was an advocate on behalf of Palestinian human rights, but also because he was a person who really sought to involve American Muslims politically. He campaigned during different elections, and he was really someone who believed in his civic duty, who believed in really engaging the system. And for that, he really became a target. And a lot of these forces I mentioned after 9/11, they really exploited the atmosphere of fear and hysteria and tried to finally, you know, paint my father as this menacing figure, as a terrorist. And at a time when the Bush administration really should have been working with American Muslim leaders and trying to build a bridge between East and West, instead they targeted my father and really tried to make an example out of him to say that if you dare to speak out, this is what will happen to you. And he ended up being arrested in February of 2003 and placed in some of the most atrocious, inhumane prison conditions that even Amnesty International condemned, and was held basically for 2 years, 2.5 years, before he was finally put on trial. The trial lasted for 6 months. The government spent millions and millions of dollars on the case and on the investigation throughout the years. And they even flew in dozens of witnesses from Israel to testify about things that my father had nothing to do with. And finally, after 6 months, the jury took 13 days to deliberate. And out of the four defendants in the case, 200 charges, there's not a single guilty verdict. This was a massive defeat for the government, a huge victory for us. But this was in December 2005. So, you know, for the past 9 years after that, we've been living in perpetual limbo.
I remember when we talked to you, and I think maybe one of the lawyers, about the acquittal and the failure to convict him on any charges. I think, and I recall, one of the lawyers read the Constitution to the jury and said, "What are we doing here?" And so that's 2005, and here it is 9 years later, and the government, I would call it much more severe than harassment. I mean, abuse, really bad stuff, continued. Mm-hmm. So the next thing that happened is, I think they said, "We're going to try you again on these charges unless you plead guilty to something." Is that right?
Exactly. So they threatened a retrial because even though most of the jurors wanted to fully acquit my father, they voted 10-2 in favor of full acquittal. Two of the jurors were holdouts, and basically when asked by the other jurors why they said that, they would just say, "We just have a feeling he's guilty." So it wasn't based on any evidence. However, the government technically did have an opportunity to try to retry him. So after months of negotiations, my father signed a plea agreement to basically end his case once and for all. And the government ended up violating the plea agreement. And basically a prosecutor here in Virginia ended up bringing him here and trying to basically retry the Florida case despite the plea agreement, and tried to get him to testify in another case against a Muslim think tank here in Virginia. And when he refused to testify, saying it was a violation of his plea agreement, he was held first on civil contempt, then charged with criminal contempt. And that's sort of where the case stopped.
Let me slow you down for a second. So what happened is, he goes to Virginia, they call him in front of a grand jury to ask him really some kind of questions about him. He refuses to testify in the grand jury, says it's a violation of the plea agreement. They weren't supposed to do this, which was more than arguable, was probably, I'm sure, was right. They hold him in civil contempt. He goes to jail again. Is that right?
Exactly. So actually, he was in custody the entire time, from the time in Florida.
Amazing.
Until he was brought up here to Virginia. He was held in custody. He actually went on a hunger strike to protest the civil contempt, first the civil contempt charges and the criminal.
So after he does the civil contempt, he does the time for the civil contempt, and then something very unusual happens, which is very rare in this country. A civil contempt is one in which they put you into prison until you testify. Supposedly, you have the keys to the jail. If you refuse to testify, you stay in until the end of the grand jury or until they realize.
But it's not supposed to be punitive.
Right. It's not punitive. It's supposed to be coercive to make you testify. So he refuses.
Exactly.
So eventually, the civil contempt is over. And then they did something that was extremely rare. They indict him for criminal contempt, really for the same charges or the same issue having to do with civil contempt, but they make a criminal case out of it. Then it becomes punitive. And then he's on criminal contempt. The only time in my recollection that we had cases like this were with the Puerto Rican FALN, the alleged bombers of places like Francis Tavern and things like that. That's the only time. They'd refuse for civil contempt. They indict them for criminal contempt. Then in 2008, so he's indicted. And then what happens after that? He's indicted for criminal contempt. And he's in custody of some form at that point. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, that's exactly true. So basically, he then, made very compelling arguments that this was explicitly taken out of his plea agreement. So in the state of Florida, every plea agreement has standard language requiring the person signing the plea agreement to basically cooperate with the government. In this case, that language was completely removed. There were conversations between the lawyers and the Department of Justice attesting to that. And in fact, both of my father's lawyers signed, sworn affidavits saying exactly what happened. But whenever the judge in the case would ask the government to do the same, they would refuse. So she asked them a few different times to tell their side of the story, what happened during the plea negotiations. And they continually avoided doing that, which is very telling. They didn't want to talk about it because they knew that indeed my father did say that as a condition of the plea agreement, he would not have to testify in any other cases. And it was very clear that the true intent of this Islamophobic and very pro-Israel prosecutor here, Gordon Kronberg, was to retry the Florida case in Virginia, basically pretending that it was really about another case when, in fact, all of the questions had to do with the Florida case. They had nothing to do with this supposed investigation of his. So then the judge basically received a couple of motions from my father's attorneys asking to fully dismiss the case. And there were no rulings in the past few years by the judge. And finally, last Friday, the government decided to drop the charges.
Stay up there for a second, because the criminal contempt was pending for 5 years. During that period, I want to hear where your father was, but I also was amazed the judge refused to decide the motion to dismiss by your father's lawyers for 5 years. And it's like remarkable. Either she thought this is like a junk case, I don't really want to dismiss it because that's maybe more than I want to do, but I also don't want to let the prosecutors proceed. So the case just gets held up, and for whatever reason, the prosecutors decide not to try and push the judge to decide it. They don't, what we call in law, mandamus, go to another court or upper court and say, this judge isn't deciding something. And she's sitting there for five years. So then at that point, there's two questions. One is, where was your father during this period? What were the conditions of confinement? What do you think really prompted this in the end? I mean, do you have any thoughts about that?
Yeah. Well, luckily, in the fall of 2008, my father was finally released on bail, because he'd been held for so long, and we're very happy and grateful about that. He was released on house arrest, and he was actually living with me, initially with me, and then after I got married with, my husband and I, and eventually even my child and my mother as well. So it was very, very nice for us to finally be reunited, for him to have some kind of semblance of normalcy after, being held in some of the worst prisons in the country in really horrible conditions. So, even though his movements were quite limited for some time, he was able to live with us, be with his family, and, you know, and live in relative freedom. So for that reason, we didn't really push the case too much. But government did try a few times to sort of force the judge to rule. They did issue a few motions, but that didn't happen, and eventually they dismissed the charges. And it's really a testament to the fact that there is no case. The think tank that was being investigated by Gordon Cromberg was never charged with a single crime. They convened one grand jury after another, and there were never any charges, never any indictments. And that's because it's a legitimate think tank that, you know, that has a presence all over the world, that does, you know, really useful scholarship. And, you know, there's no terrorist activity whatsoever. It's a witch hunt.
Layla, what was your father's position when they went after him? And why do you use the word Islamophobia? Can you put it in the context of what was happening in this country at the time?
Absolutely. Well, my father was a professor at the University of South Florida, a professor of computer engineering, when he was arrested. And it's a very complicated case. You know, as we mentioned, it stretches for over a decade. It's a case that actually outlasted the Iraq War, if you can believe it, which is why it just has so many different facets to it. It's very complicated to explain. But part
he,
of
what
the
was he doing in his charitable work at the same time that he was a professor?
He was publishing magazines. So everything he did was protected by the First Amendment, convening conferences, publishing magazines, inviting scholars from the Muslim world to come here to the U.S. to meet with American and European scholars. So really, I mean, writing articles, you know, they were never able to show that he sent any money for terrorist attacks. They were never able to show that you know, he himself had anything to do with violence. In fact, the government itself, the prosecutors, admitted that. They said, you know, we acknowledge that he has nothing to do with violence. So, you know, the case is political from the start. It's about the First Amendment, and luckily the jury really saw that.
What's going to happen now? What's the next step?
Well, the next step is in the plea agreement. My father, unfortunately, at the time, you know, his back was sort of held against the wall, but he did end up agreeing to deportation. So now we expect that he will be deported. But as a stateless Palestinian, we don't know where he'll be deported. So we're looking for a country that will take him, that will, you know, we're looking for a country that will hopefully give him some kind of citizenship, some kind of political asylum, and just hoping that he lives as a free man. Now, at the time, he mentioned the agreed-upon country for deportation was Egypt. That's where most of his family lives. However, now, given the situation in Egypt with the dictatorship there and you know, the military coup that happened a year ago, he would not be safe there. So that's not really an option anymore.
Layla, remind our listeners who your father's attorneys were.
My father's trial attorneys were Bill Moffitt and Linda Marino. Linda's based in Florida. Bill Moffitt passed away, actually, in 2009. And his attorney for the past several years with the contempt case is Jonathan Turley.
So, Layla, really, just from all of our hearts, it's really nice to hear this finally resolved in your father's favor. Outrageous. He's still being deported, in our view. Yeah. The whole thing was outrageous. And I'm glad that in your family he's really returned in the best way. So
please give him our warmest regards.
A big hug.
Absolutely will. Thank you so
Thanks,
much.
Thanks, Layla. Bye-bye, take care. Layla. Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. Last week, the U.S. Supreme Court decided the case Harris v. Quinn, ruling that some government employees didn't have to pay any fees to the unions representing them. The case was brought by 8 Illinois workers who provided home care to Medicaid recipients. Some of the plaintiffs were mothers who were personal assistants to their disabled children and who opposed joining the union. In a 5-4 majority, Justice Samuel Alito Jr. concluded there was a type of government employee called a partial public employee who can opt out of joining a union and not be required to pay union fees. Today, we're joined by labor attorney Bill Herbert to discuss the larger context of legislation affecting organized labor in the United States.
Bill Herbert, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
An important case came down last week, Bill, Harris versus Quinn. What are the ramifications of it?
Well, the court held that, the majority held that a statute in Illinois that provided for requiring employees in a bargaining unit to pay agency fee to a union was unconstitutional and therefore struck down a provision of a contract that required those employees to pay a fee for being represented by the union.
And these employees, what sort of people are they?
These are domestic workers. Illinois created in 2003 a bargaining unit that provided for certain domestic workers under a Medicaid program to allow for them to be in a collective bargaining unit in which they were considered to be state public employees, and also their terms and conditions were set by the people they serve, which are infirm people who were trying to avoid being institutionalized. So these are domestic workers who work for people who are ill, but also their salaries and their benefits are paid for by the state.
So we're discussing Harris v. Quinn, and I have a background question, because this is about paying dues. Now, in the normal situation, if you're in a union, a full-time worker, in at least many states, you have to pay dues into the union even if you aren't a member of the union. Is that right? How does it work?
Okay.
Give me the broader picture.
Let's distinguish between the private sector and the public sector.
And these are public sector in Harris v. Quinn.
These are employees defined by state law as public employees. Okay. But there's a background. In National Labor Relations Act, which is the Wagner Act, which was passed in 1935, specifically exempts domestic workers and farm workers from representational rights. These employees would be not considered to be, if they were just hired by someone to come into their home, would not have any rights under the National Labor Relations Act. And so in the National Labor Relations Act in 1947, Taft-Hartley was passed. Taft-Hartley allows for states to pass laws which are called right-to-work laws or referred to as right-to-work laws. And one aspect of that is that a state can prohibit a contract to provide that people who decide not to join the union still have to pay a fee related to their representation. So when the union negotiates a salary increase, that the work done for that has to everyone in the union would have to pay. Under a right to work regimen, the people who decide not to be in the union do not have to pay the union for the representational rights.
Even though they're getting the benefits of the union.
Even though they're getting the benefits.
There's certain what are called right to work states, in a way I'm being broad about this, in which the members who don't join the union don't have to pay even though they're getting the benefits.
Correct. Now that's in the private sector under the National Labor Relations Act. And so these employees were treated under Illinois statute, in which Illinois decided that it was going to pass a statute which was going to require these employees in a bargaining unit to pay the fee for representation. And the Supreme Court found for the first time that right to work for these type of employees is unconstitutional. And so they've basically made a constitutional...
So we have a public union in Illinois, right? These people, in this case, Harris v. Quinn. Illinois passed a law saying that even if you're not part of the union is considered your bargaining agent and you have to pay dues into it. Then you use the word, you call that a right to work law? Isn't it the opposite?
Yes.
Okay, that's what
let me clarify.
Okay.
Yeah. First, these employees are under a state statute which required them that if a contract is reached that they would have to pay a fee, not dues, but a fee for the representational rights that they have received based on the fact the union has negotiated on behalf of them. The facts in this case are interesting. In 10 years, the union for these employees got salary increases, doubling. The salaries got doubled. They got health insurance paid for by the state, and a series of other benefits. And under this decision...
Before we go to the decision, Illinois said, and under its law, you have to pay a fee for all this work the union is doing. So then some people decide this isn't a good idea. We don't like this. We don't think if we're not in the union or whatever, we don't want to pay the fees.
Correct. And so the court, when it struck down this provision, found that these were not public employees, classically public employees. These were what the majority referred to as quasi-public employees. And for public employees, there was a case decided in 1977 called Abood, which came out of Detroit. In the 1977 case, public employees were found that the Supreme Court found that it was constitutional to establish a procedure where people who are not members of a public sector union still have to pay a fee for their representational rights, that's negotiations, et cetera, but don't have to pay for what is sometimes referred to as ideological work, which would be a political activity such as supporting candidates, et cetera. And so there was a procedure created where people can object and they can go and raise issues and seek to have only the monies paid, only monies relevant to collective bargaining be a part of their fee. And so that was Abood, and the plaintiffs in this case wanted that decision to be overruled. And so many people, both management and labor in public sector, were concerned about the destabilization that would take place in labor relations if, in fact, Abood was overturned. And there are many public policy reasons why
Abood required public sector employees to pay for the services of the union, essentially.
It required employees who were not members of the union to pay a fee for the representation.
Now, this case is a subset of Abood, right?
This case did not overturn Abood.
Right.
But there's a lot of language in the decision very critical of Abood to the extent that it should raise concerns with respect to what may lie in the future, because there are many reasons set forth in the majority's decision to say that Abood was wrongfully decided.
Because these are what they considered quasi-public or partial or not full-time, right?
Well, the dissent got it right. Okay. They're what would be called joint employers, okay. The joint employees.
Can you define for us the partial public employee?
Well, in this case, because these employees are domestic workers, they have an employment relationship with the person that they are taking care of. The person who's being cared for has the ability to hire and fire and other aspects of the employment relationship. But the heart of wages and benefits are something that is set by the state. And so you have what was called, in labor parlance, it's called joint employer relationship. The court in this case, in the Harris case, ruled that it's unconstitutional for these employees to be required to pay a fee for the benefits that they receive based on the representation provided by the union.
How could it be unconstitutional? What's this part of the Constitution?
The rationale for the majority's decision was that because the balancing between the different interests, the First Amendment right of individuals not to be forced to be compelled to pay for something that they don't agree with would be something that would be unconstitutional. But it's interesting to compare this to Citizens United. Okay, in Citizens United, shareholders who are opposed to what a corporation may spend in terms of money for political action, in terms of supporting candidates, et cetera, had no say. And the Supreme Court found in Citizens United that the First Amendment gives corporations the First Amendment rights, and the shareholders have no say. While in this case, the Supreme Court held that these employees do not have to pay anything for being represented by the union in collective bargaining with the state.
Attorney Bill Herbert, let me ask you a follow-the-dollar question, because right to work is usually derided by people like us as right to work for less. And I wanted to ask you know, why that is, and just who are these people who are affected by this recent decision? Men, women, young, old, white, black, otherwise, what are we talking about here?
Well, domestic workers are generally low-wage employees, very high turnover, people who generally receiving the low end of the pay scale. And so for many people, the idea is that these are the perfect people who would want representation. These would be the people who would be interested in getting better wages and benefits. And in terms of the people who do the job, they are people who are highly regulated, understandably, because they're providing direct care. So the state is very involved with their terms and conditions. So the issue then becomes the people who decide not to join the union will now be allowed to be given representation, but not have to pay for any services with respect to that representation if they so choose.
Put it in a broader context for us. What does this represent? I mean, if I were looking at it as a sort of, you know, layperson not knowing union law very much, I would say what they're ultimately trying to do is get rid of any idea that someone who doesn't join the union has to pay anything in a broad way, both public and private. I don't know if that's way down the road, maybe, or somewhat down the road. But what are we really looking at in terms of these issues?
What we're looking at is constitutionalizing this concept, which was previously statutory in the private sector, and making it such that other statutes around the country where the states have intervened in providing for representational rights for people excluded from the National Labor Relations Act, these other statutes may now be challenged based on this ground. And in the future, it's based on the language of the decision, it's conceivable that this case, at least the verbiage in the majority's decision, which Justice Kagan referred to as gratuitous dicta about the Abu decision and why it was wrongfully decided, is something that may come back to be utilized in future cases, in future challenges against the requiring members of a bargaining unit who are not union members to pay a fee.
So let me go back to what you said in the beginning. When they passed the National Labor Relations Act, there were at least two categories exempted, domestic workers and farm workers. And so what happened essentially is when those people started to organize, states said, well, if you're a domestic worker and you're organized into a union, in our particular state, we're going to make everybody at least pay for the services.
That's essentially right. I mean, in Illinois and in other states, domestic workers have been working in doing a lot of work towards organizing to provide for collective bargaining. But for example, in New York, they don't have the right to collectively bargain, nor farm workers. But in other states, both farm workers and domestic workers have rights to unionize. This decision, where depending on the structure that the state designs, could be subject to the other statutes may be subject to challenge legally.
Right. So what it would mean to me, let's say I'm an organizer for domestic workers or farm workers, what it would mean is I'm going to have a much harder time if I'm a union organizer, because if I can't require everybody to pay for my services, that means a lot of the people I organized and a lot of the people I'm getting the benefit for are not going to pay, and therefore the union isn't going to have any money. I'm trying to figure out how this affects the actual practice on the ground.
On the ground, and you've read from stories about union organizing in right-to-work states, it requires a lot of energy and a lot of internal organizing, persistent and consistent organizing.
When you say right-to-work state, that's a state when people don't have to actually pay
right
for the services or dues, and therefore you're saying the organizing is much harder.
The organizing is much more consistent and perpetual in the sense you're always trying to bring people in to encourage them to join the union. And so what happens is that pushes a greater degree of pressure for organizing. One of the ironies in this case is that one of the reasons why these agency fee arrangements have been states have put them into place is to create stability within bargaining units, not having multiple unions trying to come in and trying to organize employees, or having conflicts between members who are paying for the services against people who are not paying. So the legislatures, when they passed in Illinois, for example, when they passed the statute, were seeking to provide stability in the workplace. Now, in the situation of domestic workers, remember, they're all working separately. So that would increase the difficulties in terms of organizing and getting people to join members. You'd have to go and find everyone because they're all being assigned to specific homes or specific apartments.
Are about 26 states right-to-work states?
I think that's correct. The last state that passed right-to-work was actually Michigan.
That was a big defeat because most of these states were initially in the South, weren't they, Bill?
Yes, most states are right-to-work states are in the South. But there's organizing going on in right-to-work states, and there are unions that are seeking to be there. There's a lot of work in the healthcare industry, et cetera.
Let's step back and look at this in the overall context of what's happened in this country. For example, there hasn't been an increase in real wages in the United States for 40 years. The income disparity is growing. The wealth disparity is growing. How does this case fit into that general trend?
Well, the way I look at it is, we frequently the current time is being described as a new Gilded Age. And a new Gilded Age is about wage disparity. But there's also other things, including job security and issues involving pensions. And if you look at it, you have an issue, job security being tenure in the public sector, tenure is under attack. pensions are under attack. And now there's an attack upon the idea of having to pay a representative to provide you with representation. So what's happening is that on some levels, a lot of the initiatives that have been enacted in the 20th century are being stripped away. And it's being tied with basically the new Gilded Age is leading to the old Gilded Age, in the sense that things like job security and pensions and collective bargaining are being attacked. And so it's kind of those are the things that provide for a good standard of living and has historically a good standard of living for the middle class.
Now, I know you're a specialist in public sector unions, right, Bill?
I know a little bit.
Right. So can you tell us what's the pushback by the unions in this, SEIU and others, maybe not them in particular, but I'm saying there's a bunch of public sector unions out there. How are they reacting to this? What are they thinking about?
Well, I mean, the good news of the decision is that Abood was not overturned. That was the concern. And as I said, I know there are employer attorneys and union attorneys who were all very, very fearful that Abood was going to be overturned. And the concern.
And when we say Abood overturned, that means that workers in public sector unions who didn't want to pay dues or at least weren't in the unions but just wanted to take advantage would have been able to simply say, we're not going to be in the union, we're not going to pay dues, we're not going to pay for services, you have to, but we'll take advantage of your bargaining force anyway. That's still the law at this point.
For the public sector, that's still the law. Abood was not. And the speculation is, in terms of commentators, is the belief that within the majority there was differences because Abood has been reaffirmed by the Supreme Court so many times that for them to overturn it right now would be such a shocking attack on the concept of collective bargaining in the public sector. And the majority of decisions actually is very critical of a number of aspects of collective bargaining in the public sector. And so that language, what Justice Kagan referred to as gratuitous dicta, may come back in future cases.
So you're saying there's relief, at least within the union sector as well as some management sector, that Abood wasn't overturned?
Correct.
What do you think the next steps are going to be by the people who want to get either Abood overturned or narrow the collective bargaining rights?
Well, I think that there's language in this decision which probably you may be seeing other legal challenges. One legal challenge that may be coming down is something to the Railway Labor Act, which was a separate statute in the private sector dealing with transportation, airlines, railroads. There's specific language in this decision, in the Harris v. Quinn decision, critical of some of the decisions relating to the Railway Labor Act, which may be the basis for a challenge under that statute, as well as other state laws around the country.
Bill, as we close out this important segment on these efforts by, I don't know whether they're called neoliberals or conservatives, to destroy labor organizing, can you summarize the Harris decision for our listeners before we leave you?
The Harris decision narrowly struck down a particular state statute in Illinois dealing with what has been termed as quasi-public sector employees. Those are employees who provide services and are employees of the state as well as employees of individual people that they're serving. And it found that the agency fee arrangement under that statute was unlawful, or under that contract was unlawful. And it was a very strong dissent by Justice Kagan, and we'll see how the case, what happens in the future as cases evolve.
Thank you, Bill, for being with us. I'm sorry it was on such an occasion of losing a Supreme Court case, but it's always good to hear you talk about unions, organizing, collective bargaining. Thank you.
Thanks, Bill.
Thanks, Bill.
Thank you.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.
Now, if you want higher wages, let me tell you what to do. You got to talk to the workers in the shop with you. You got to build you a union, got to make it strong. But if you all stick together, boys, it won't be long. You get shorter hours, better working conditions, vacations with pay, take your kid to the seashore. It ain't quite this simple, so I better explain just why you got to ride on the union train. Cause if you wait for the boss to raise your pay, we'll all be awaiting till Judgment Day. We'll all be buried, gone to heaven. St. Peter will be the straw boss then. Now you know you're underpaid, but the boss says you ain't. He speeds up the work till you're about to faint. You may be down and out, but you ain't beaten. You can pass out a leaflet and call a meeting, talk it over. speak your mind. Decide to do something about it. Of course, the boss may persuade some poor damn fool to go to your meeting and act like a stool, but you can always tell a stool, though, that's a fact. He's got a yaller streak running down his back. He doesn't have to stool. He'll always get along on what he takes out of blind men's cups. You got a union now and you're sitting pretty. Put some of the boys on the steering committee. The boss won't listen when one guy squawks, cause he's got to listen when the union talks. He'd better be mighty lonely. Everybody decide to walk out on him. Suppose they're working you so hard it's just outrageous, and they're paying you all starvation wages. You go to the boss and the boss would yell, before I raise your pay, I'd see you all in hell. Well, he's puffing a big cigar, feeling mighty slick, cause he thinks he's got your union licked. Well, he looks out the window and what does he see but a thousand pickets, and they all agree he's a bastard. Unfair! Slave driver. Bet he beats his wife. Now, boys, you come to the hardest time. The boss will try to bust your picket line. He'll call out the police, the National Guard. They'll tell you it's a crime to have a union card. They'll raid your meeting. They'll hit you on the head. They'll call every one of you a damn red unpatriotic. Japanese spies. Sabotaging national defense. But out at Ford's, here's what they found. And out at Vulti, here's what they found. And out at Alice Chalmers, here's what they found. And down at Bethlehem, here's what they found. That if you don't let red baiting break you up, and if you don't let stool pigeons break you up, and if you don't let vigilantes break you up, and if you don't let race hatred break you up, you'll win. What I mean, take it easy, but take it.